From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Super Tuesday was so last week. And like all the other traditional benchmarks of 2012's presidential season, Super Tuesday, like Iowa, like New Hampshire, was meh. Call it Meh Tuesday, partly because fewer than half the states participated, as did in 2008, but mostly because, despite the breathless expostulations of pundits, it resolved nothing.
And so if you look at that and you say, okay, what's Romney's problem?
What's not?
Well, he's not connecting. He's not even connecting to the people he should be connecting.
Now, this is a guess, clearly labeled, but if Republicans get to their convention with no nominee, I predict they'll pick someone other than those in the current field.
That is the battleground state of Ohio. He will be able to secure his claim to the nomination only if he beats Rick Santorum in that big state.
That last prediction was simply wrong. The previous one was meaningless, and the first one sounded like a little cry of pain modified to fit your screen.
Typically, political pundits are able to get away with making predictions that are spectacularly wrong because there's no real downside to it. Make an extraordinary claim and you'll get a ton of attention. If a few years later it turns out you were wrong, well, it's not as if somebody's going to go back and check your work. That is, until now. Sanjay Ayer is one of the minds behind Pundit Tracker, a new site that will keep track of the predictions that pundits make and score whether or not they actually turn out to be, you know, true.
One of the big problems is the scoring systems. The traditional approach to evaluating pundits uses what we call a hit rate or batting average approach. So let's say you make 10 calls, you get 8 of them right, you have an 80% hit rate, right? That sounds great, but the problem is it's really meaningless without context. And that's really the crux of our scoring system is we will factor in how bold a call is. So the person who predicts the financial crisis will get more credit than me who predicts, you know, the sun will rise tomorrow.
So how far have you gotten on this?
We're running the site as a blog right now. The full launch is scheduled for the springtime, but we've put a couple of content pieces up there already. One of them is a sports analysis where we analyze the football picks from all the pundits from ESPN and Yahoo and CBS. That study showed that the results were decidedly mediocre. Actually, the users of those websites, by and large, outperformed the experts. And that really corroborates a lot of the work that's been done in this industry in the past. But there are counterexamples. We did a study on finance looking at Barron's as a financial periodical. And they do an event every year where they bring in a group of experts and ask them to make their stock picks for the following year. And looking at that track record, it was actually quite good.
All right. So far, Sanjay, you've given us stock market calls and sporting predictions. But for obvious reasons, political predictions tend not to be so black and white. How do you account for that in coming up with your algorithm or whatever it is that you bring to bear on this problem?
So there's two ways we can go about kind of addressing that issue. One is filter the calls on the front end. So if a call is too vague to score or the pundit's hedging too much, we just won't put that call on the site. But the second way, and I think the more interesting way, is to make our algorithm flexible enough. So if they make a call that something could happen or is likely to happen, we can give them partial credit if they're right. And if they hedge a call, we can give them partial credit as well.
Now, all of this presupposes that the function of pundits is to provide actual insight and to accurately predict the future. I would assert they're just there for dramatic tension and confrontation so that viewers can watch to have their worldviews either validated or to have a fight picked. Does it matter ultimately to CNN or Fox News Channel if their pundits are right or wrong?
To the extent that networks are just trying to maximize ratings, extreme viewpoints will sell better than nuanced viewpoints, right? But if you can provide users with some sort of informational metric that evaluates how good a pundit is, it allows them to maybe cut through some of that media filter. You know, I was just watching a financial show a couple weeks ago, and they were interviewing a pundit who we've looked at the data, and his results are frankly terrible. What they did when they introduced him was cherry-pick the two calls he got right and introduced him as an expert. If we can provide data that cuts through all those filters and biases, we think in the end the public will have demand for it.
Let's just say the world of cable news is not quite as cynical as I asserted. Do you think they are responsible for vetting the records of pundits?
I think they have some responsibility, but the problem is the only time people refer back to old news, which includes past predictions, is when there's a trigger, and that trigger is typically an event. So we'll go back, we'll look through the archives. Some people are bound to have predicted everything, and so we'll elevate that person to oracle status, you know, at least temporarily. But the problem is, on the flip side, a non-event is non-news. So there's no corresponding search when a prediction doesn't happen for the pundits who made those failed predictions. It's an inherent skew that's more prone to uncovering hits than misses. And it gives us, the public, kind of a warped sense of how accurate pundits are.
One final thing, Sanjay. The ascendancy of fact-checking has really brought a whole new level of vetting to political advertising and debate claims and so on, but hasn't seemed to chasten politicians any. They've just figured out a sort of new way to lie. Do you think ultimately that you are going to have a material effect on the prognostication game?
If we can really get the data right and convey that to consumers, there'll be a natural weeding out. You know, if a pundit is showing up on TV, you know, say we do a grade score and he's got a D, over time we think that'll start to whittle away at his credibility and people will at least pay more attention to how his calls turn out or not.
All right, but two cautionary words for you. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Jim Cramer.
He will be one of the first pundits we will track. Let's put it that way.
Sanjay, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Sanjay Ayer is the founder and CEO of Pundit Tracker.
If you were in Georgia during Super Tuesday, you might have seen this attack ad against Newt Gingrich paid for by the pro-Romney PAC, Restore Our Future.
While Newt was Speaker, earmarks exploded. He co-sponsored a bill with Nancy Pelosi that would have given $60 million a year to a UN program supporting China's brutal one-child policy.
The implication is that Gingrich was surreptitiously supporting an abortion program overseas, a poison pill for any Republican campaign. But according to factcheck.org, the bill in question specifically prohibited, quote, involuntary sterilization or abortion or the coercion of any person to accept family planning services. If there was only some way to keep such distortions off the air. Well, maybe there is. While television stations are required by law to run ads bought by a presidential campaign, regardless of their content, stations do have the right to refuse to run third-party ads, i.e., ads from super PACs. The Annenberg Public Policy Center has created a campaign called Stand By Your Ad, which hopes to encourage, or shame, stations into dropping misleading or false advertising. Kathleen Hall Jamieson is a professor of communications at the Annenberg School. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how exactly do you plan to compel stations to stop running dishonest ads?
Well, compel really isn't the verb. The verb is encourage through community pressure.
Let me rephrase that. How exactly do you intend to blackmail stations to stop running dishonest ads?
By asking people who are viewers of those stations to go to factcheck.org, which is the sister site of factcheck.org, where they can find their media market and the stations that they watch. And then they'll see a letter that we've written for them, which they can write anything they want into. And then they cut and paste it into their own email and send it to the stations. And to help, we're posting up the fact checks on the ads that are airing and the names of the stations that are airing them as we roll through the primary states. So we're hoping that station owners and their corporate owners will feel the friendly encouragement of community norms speaking to them and speaking to their better natures.
We should note that there have been a number of studies of super PAC ads, and they tend to be more negative and more mendacious than the ads directly sponsored by campaigns, right?
The further you get from the candidate, the more likely you're going to have high levels of attack and higher levels of inaccuracy.
But if the super PACs won't tweak them to make them accurate, do you really think that TV stations will or even can afford to turn them down?
If the biggest, most reputable station said we're going to insist on accuracy, the advertiser would have to change because the advertiser needs the audience.
How do you measure the success of your project?
That's the real dilemma. The stations and the advertisers have one thing in common. They have no interest in publicizing any incident in which the station has insisted on accuracy and an ad has been changed. So you're never going to get a causal inference out of this.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that the advertising that aired on Super Tuesday was more accurate proportionately than the material that had aired before. We don't know whether that's because of the natural dynamics of the race or because of the concern that the Republicans are trashing each other to such an extent that they're going to damage their eventual nominee. But we do know we had a higher level of accuracy across Super Tuesday. And we know that we're in the mix. So we know that it has to be better that we're in the mix than that we're not. Newspaper editors, please editorialize to your community and your community's television stations, reminding them that they can insist on the accuracy of third-party ads. That would be super PAC ads, party ads, special interest group ads. If we knew that we could increase the likelihood that the stations would be aware of their right by contacting them and by having newspapers editorialize about this, and if we knew that we're in a political environment in which no one is served if people cast votes based on deception, why wouldn't we take the 2 minutes to email the station on the off chance that it might make a difference? And if we don't actually know whether it did or not, it still has only taken 2 minutes, and it might.
Okay. Kathleen, will you say your name and then say that you just stood by that message?
My name is Kathleen Hall Jamison, and I stand by this message. I'm the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and the director of FactCheck.org, sister site of FactCheck.org.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a Russian journalist keeps talking even after hired hooligans break his jaw. And advertisers bail after Russia's rush to judgment.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Speaking of political ads that venture beyond the pale, here's one backing Vladimir Putin that was airing in the run-up to Russia's presidential race last week. A woman is sitting in a doctor's chair speaking to, well, maybe it's her gynecologist, about how she's a little bit afraid of her first time. I'll voice this over.
Понимаете, доктор? Просто мне очень страшно.
You know, doctor, I'm very scared.
Я вас прекрасно понимаю.
I understand completely. Everyone is afraid the first time.
Не знаю.
I know I'm afraid, although my choice is one of love.
Этого не стоит бояться.
Then you don't need to be afraid.
Главное верить вашему избраннику, потому что вера —
because trust is love, so you can trust your choice. And then the camera closes in on a picture of Putin on Time magazine, and later she's seen happily walking to the polls. There have been a few such-like ads depicting Putin as a paragon of manly strength and a master deflowerer, I guess. Anyway, as expected, Putin won, and won, in fact, despite numerous reports of vote-counting irregularities. Oleg Kashin is a longtime reporter and correspondent for Kommersant, a Russian newspaper. Oleg, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, one reason why I ran that ad is because it struck me as both hilarious and obvious, and also perhaps a little outdated. Are people still regarding Putin as this paragon of manly virtue? I mean, he has been wearing his shirt a lot more lately.
I'm sure that all these ads are addressed to only one man, to Vladimir Putin.
So these ads are really for Putin himself.
For Putin himself, really. To tell him that a lot of people love him, girls love him, because it's important for him to think that I'm young, I'm strong, I'm a man.
Okay, we know that the journalism that matters is on television, and that is pretty much controlled by the Russian government. There have been some organizations that have been allowed to criticize, but they don't have enormous audiences. And there is also a shocking number of attacks against journalists.
Like me.
Like you, which is exactly why we have you here today, and it's such an honor to meet you. Usually it's investigative journalists who are grievously injured or murdered. You weren't an investigative journalist. Can you describe what kind of journalism you do?
Some kind of journalism of opinion and literature. Russian word is очерк. I don't know in English, maybe feature.
A feature writer.
Feature journalism.
And you wrote in the New York Times that you never claimed to be a paragon of human rights like Anna Politkovskaya or an investigative reporter like Paul Klebnikov, both dead, both killed.
Both dead, both killed, yeah.
Which is why the attack on you was so bizarre.
Because I didn't tell secrets of authority, but I named the things their own names, you know?
You called a spade a spade.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was all it took.
Yes. I think I was attacked because during Putin's 10 years, free speech in Russia decreased. 10 years ago, it was normal
to criticize Putin.
Putin and his team. But now it's impossible, it's prohibited.
What happened to you in November of 2010?
On the night of November 2010, I came home and near the wall of my house, I was met by two people armed by iron stick, and they made about 50 beats for me.
They struck you 50 times.
And after 3 months, I spent in hospitals. 3 months. I'm sure that a pro-Kremlin organization was the organizer of this crime. I think it was football hooligans paid by Nashi.
Nashi means ours. Mm-hmm. It is basically a kind of activist youth group that was organized under Putin to counter pro-democracy forces that were growing in the streets.
I wrote about such situation before. During the 2005, when football hooligans, fans of Spartak Moscow, was arranged by Nashi to beat activists of left organization.
Nashi hires these football hooligans, these fans of the Russian team Spartak, as mercenaries to beat.
My last article about these relations between Nashi and football hooligans was 6 months before attack.
Did they say anything when they were beating you?
Keep silence. But if was broken my jaws, my finger, and my leg, I think the message was don't write, don't tell, and don't walk.
Do you think things have improved since you were attacked in 2010?
After my attack, I think it was the first time when journalists became unified. Because in Russia, there is no real journalist trade unions, for example, and other organizations. But using social networks, a lot of journalists became a unity front.
The journalists were somewhat scattered and they became a unified front after your attack.
After.
And yet you wrote shortly after your attack mm-hmm. that nevertheless, the Russian people themselves don't seem to care very much.
Because now the level of violence in Russia is so high, not depends of journalists or not journalists.
I mean, there's so much random killing going on that journalists are among the targets hardly matters.
Yeah, in fact.
So what are the rules of the game now for journalists?
The first rule of this game is don't criticize, don't investigate, and keep silence, keep silence, keep silence. I don't want to keep silence, but I know the only way to be in safety to keep silence, silence, silence. But I'm not agree with this. During the Putin's 10 years, a lot of opposition leaders were removed from public space. And now one of the most popular slogan of Putin, if not Putin, but nobody. And me and some of my colleagues from television, from other magazines, for example, we were organizers of riots in Moscow.
You were among the organizers of the demonstration in
Moscow? Bolotna and Sakharov Prospect. I was a member of organizing committee of these demonstrations.
You're becoming a politician.
I don't want to become a politician.
But an activist.
Not activist. I'd like to be a journalist. But if it's impossible, I can maybe become a writer.
What is a journalist?
Journalist is a person who tells truth.
So if you become a writer, will you still tell the truth?
No, it will be fiction. Now it's so interesting because a lot of journalists became some kind of writers, poets. it's more easy to make a poem, not a newspaper investigation.
Back in the 70s, there was the tradition of art in which the message was между линия, in between the lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think you're returning to that?
Yes, maybe, but I don't want to write between lines. I'd like to write lines and do it in Russia and not in immigration.
Do you see the potential for change?
Yes, yes, because we saw a lot of people during the demonstration in Moscow who want change and who can make change. I'm sure that Putin, he will leave Kremlin in 1 year, 2 years, not 6 years. I'm sure.
How can you be sure?
Intuition.
Oleg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oleg Kashin is a special correspondent for the Moscow newspaper Kommersant. He's in the U.S. for a few weeks on a fellowship with the Paul Klebnikov Fund, which was founded in tribute to Forbes Russia journalist Paul Klebnikov, who was assassinated in Moscow in 2004.
Last week, in a quintessential display of his sense of humor and proportion, radio strongman Rush Limbaugh went nutso on Georgetown Law student Sandra Fluck, who'd had the temerity to seek health coverage for birth control pills.
What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex? What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute. She wants to be paid to have sex.
Limbaugh apologized twice for what he characterized as a poor choice of words, but no one was buying. Literally. By week's end, shamed by the uproar in the media, both social and mainstream, more than 40 advertisers had bailed from the program. But before that mass exodus began, blogger Ellie Reeve of TheAtlanticWire.com phoned advertisers to see what plans they had. And what she found was surprising. Many of the sponsors told her they weren't sponsors at all, at least not intentionally.
Netflix offered a really detailed explanation, which was the ad had accidentally been dropped in during the half-hour break where they read the news and the weather and stuff like that. Ambrin, it's a weight loss supplement. They say that they're a bulk buyer of ads, that they buy remnant ads, and they have no choice over when those air. Goodwill, on the other hand, said that they had bought ads on a sister station of the radio station I listen to, WMAL in D.C., and that the ads had accidentally aired on Rush Limbaugh's show.
And what about Geico, which is one of the big broadcast advertisers in the country? You heard one of their ads on his show, right?
That's right. Geico said that since 2004, they have made sure not to advertise on Rush's show. But if you go and you Google it off and on, there have been the controversies over Geico advertising on Rush Limbaugh's show. It's an ongoing problem.
Would it be fair to say that their explanation did not correspond with your reporting on this issue?
I'll put it this way. If it's a mistake, it happens a lot. It's happened over and over and over.
What have we learned through this exercise?
The power of social media. If you look at the Facebook pages of these advertisers, the small ones especially, their pages are filled with angry people, mostly women, saying, how could you associate with these kind of comments? So you can understand why they responded so quickly, even after Limbaugh apologized.
Here's a question for you. Does this teach you about being careful with your words?
Yes, especially since I write on a blog. We write very fast. There's always the temptation to come up with something really catchy as a way to describe somebody. I will not be going with slut or prostitute, that's for sure.
Probably a very good move. Thank you very much, Ellie.
Thank you, Bob.
Ellie Reeve blogs for TheAtlanticWire.com. If what advertisers told her is true, that they were accidental underwriters of Rush's Rush to Judgment, and brands that spend millions of dollars on radio commercials don't even know what they're buying, this suggests an obvious follow-up question. Huh? Yet Kim Vasey, director of radio ad purchases for the media buying giant Group M Media, says the denials are quite plausible.
Because if you're buying a program such as a Rush, we know exactly where that spot is running if we buy program specific. If we're just buying day part, morning, midday, afternoon, across 1,000 radio stations around the country, you may lose sight of where that may inadvertently end up.
I can see how an advertiser would have his spots fall on ears that he hadn't specifically requested. But I also know that advertisers care deeply about what they call the editorial environment. Advertisers who might advertise, for example, in People magazine might not want to advertise an outlaw biker. Aren't there advertisers who make clear to their media buying houses that they don't want any part of a controversial talk show like Rush Limbaugh's?
Yes, and generally on the traffic instructions that go to the stations, there will be a space on that page for an advertiser to write down all the different types of programs that they do not want to be in. Unfortunately, in several situations, what happened with the Rush Limbaugh show is that those traffic instructions were not really being adhered to correctly, and they inadvertently fell into a show.
Now, there has been quite an exodus of advertisers. Between 40 and quite a bit more than 40 have been reported. Do you think this could kill the program? It's happened before.
You know, there's been situations with Rush specifically before. There's been situations with other talk show personalities like Michael Savage, Dr. Laura over time. You know, the biggest offense, I guess, was with Imus, and that actually, you know, was the demise of his show. Certainly, it will have an impact on their, you know, bottom line revenue for quite some time.
Now, Limbaugh thundered for his audience that he doesn't care about this because he's got 18,000 advertisers just champing at the bit to be on the Rush Limbaugh show. Has your phone been ringing off the hook with 18,000 advertisers trying to buy time?
Not one. And in fact, I did receive a call, however, from one of the companies that we do business with that has inventory.
Could you reproduce for me the sort of tone of voice?
Hey, Kim, this probably doesn't come as a big surprise to you, but in case you do have any advertisers out there, I have plenty of spots to sell you if you want to have a great deal on inventory.
Fire sale, everything must go?
I think I could probably get it for less than fire sale prices, like $0. Yeah, but I didn't have one single taker.
All right, Kim, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Kim Vasey is managing partner and director of radio at Group M. And now for a few of your letters. A couple of weeks ago, Brooks spoke to John Alan Schwartz, director of the cult film Faces of Death, about what was real in the film and what was staged, and how the faking of segments affected the overall message of the film. Some of our listeners actually found the revelation of fake segments a relief. A listener named Don emailed us to say, "Thank you for the Faces of Death piece. The depravity of the monkey brains scene has haunted me for 25 years, and I'm relieved to hear it was a fake."
But a number of listeners criticized my skepticism about the practice of monkey brain consumption. Listener Edwin Kay wrote, quote, "I have heard of monkey brains as food. My Googling the topic makes it reasonably clear that monkey brains are eaten as food in some parts of China and Indonesia." Listener Maeve agrees. She says, "It's not only possible, it is true. In That's Disgusting by Rachel Hertz, she writes that, quote, chefs can serve you monkey brains from a living monkey sitting at your feet with its skull carved open." Duly noted, I will never again express surprise at the practice of monkey brain eating.
On an episode that aired on the weekend of February 10th, I interviewed lawyer Mary Prevost, who was representing a man arrested at a sporting event after swearing at the opposing team's fans. Prevost said his arrest for resisting arrest was a violation of her client's First Amendment rights, and Prevost asserted this.
You have the absolute right to resist an unlawful arrest. So if whatever precipitated the arrest was wrongful to begin with, then what flows from there as far as charges go, generally speaking, should be thrown out.
Several listeners wrote in to tell us they didn't agree with that interpretation of the law. Listener Daniel E. Ciora wrote, quote, I've been a practicing criminal defense lawyer for over 10 years, and in most jurisdictions, you do not have the right to resist an illegal arrest by a police officer. The only time you have a right to resist arrest is when the police officer uses excessive force.
We appreciate the legal advice and everything else you have to say, so keep your letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org or comment on our website at www.onthemedia.org. And tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name, okay? Please?
Coming up, Wikipedia's built-in resistance to historical revisionism, even when it's the truth. And YouTube's algorithm is defeated by women bearing breasts.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Historian Timothy Messer-Cruz has devoted the past decade to one pivotal American moment, the 1886 Haymarket riot and trial. If you go to Wikipedia, you'll be reminded that the riot took place in Chicago, where workers were demonstrating in favor of an 8-hour workday. An unknown person detonated a dynamite bomb near a group of police officers. A gun battle broke out, and by day's end, seven cops and four civilians were dead. In the ensuing trial, the alleged rioters received seven death sentences and one 15-year prison term, despite the fact that the prosecution conceded that none of the defendants had actually thrown the deadly bomb. If you had checked Wikipedia last year, you would have read that though the trial went on for 6 weeks, the prosecution never introduced a single piece of evidence. But that last jaw-dropping fact is not true. Trying to remove that false fact from Wikipedia turned into a bit of a crusade for Messer-Cruz. He'd first gotten interested in the canard of the evidence-less prosecution after a student in one of his classes asked about it a decade ago.
One of my students raised her hand, and she said, Professor, I don't quite understand. If there was no evidence presented, what did they talk about for 6 weeks? Well, I said I'd find out, and it's taken me about 10 years to answer a question.
One of the things you found out is that actually there was a heap of evidence.
In fact, some of the evidence presented was groundbreaking and landmark evidence, some of the first chemical forensic evidence ever introduced in an American trial. There were witnesses who turned state's evidence who had been party to secret meetings in which the bombing was planned. There were other witnesses who testified that they actually helped one of the defendants assemble bombs the very day of the riot and bombing.
What happened when you tried to correct the error on Wikipedia?
Within about 5 minutes, the change was reversed. Somebody informed me that although I had cited the trial transcript itself, coroner's records, things of that sort, my sources were invalid because they were primary sources. They were the actual evidence from history, and Wikipedia depends upon published secondary sources. One of the self-appointed Wikipedia editors told me that Wikipedia was not about the truth, it was about verifiability. And the reason for having a policy stressing secondary sources is so that the evidence can be verified by anybody in the world. Almost all the sources that I was citing, the primary sources, were available through electronic means as well. So the access to them really shouldn't have been an issue.
So your book comes out, you change the entry referencing your work, and voila, mission accomplished, right?
That's what I thought. I thought my patience had paid off and that I had followed the rules. Once again, my changes were reverted back to the original page. And when I tried to change them an additional time, this time I was informed that I was possibly vandalizing the page. And that's when I really gave up because I didn't want to be labeled a vandal.
But ultimately, your point of view did make it on to the Wikipedia page. How?
In early February, I published a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education just detailing my experience with Wikipedia. And as soon as that piece came out, within a couple of days, most of the changes I had been recommending had been made to reflect my research.
It seems like Wikipedia is a little broken here. You're a specialist in this topic, yet you were unable to add your specialized knowledge to Wikipedia because you ran afoul of their thorny editing culture, right?
Well, that's right. And I'm glad you described it as a culture, because I think we're also dealing here with a culture clash. Clearly, I come from an academic experience where if an editor doesn't like what I'm submitting, they just simply say, I don't like it, either revise it or go somewhere else. In this case, there seems to be a culture that you need to be persistent. You need to suggest changes, and if they're rejected, you need to go back at it again. If you look at the Wikipedia talk pages about this event, the gist of them is observing that I did not persist sufficiently to make the changes happen.
But Timothy, could you argue that actually your failure to change Wikipedia represents a strength of the system rather than a failing? I mean, you can't really have a system where anyone who's published a book has an absolute standing to change an article. And it's hard for an amateur community to adjudicate conflicting claims.
Well, I would agree. The problem, though, is that, especially in historical interpretation, there is something called a fact.
Oh, tosh.
There are some types of information which simply don't suit themselves to crowdsourcing. And I would say that historical scholarship is one of those. My understanding of crowdsourcing is that it really works best with things that people have direct real-world knowledge about. But when you ask people about events that happened long before probably their grandparents were born, well, they certainly would have no direct experience. So I'm not sure that crowdsourcing is really the way to bring the best information forward. Unfortunately, with some topics, you do have to rely on some degree of expertise. I'm not sure how you build that into the system.
Have you tried to make any changes in any Wikipedia articles since this one?
No, I have not. Not even the Haymarket page.
Wow. Once burned, twice shy?
Pretty much. Yes, I'd say so.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Timothy Messer-Cruz is a professor in the School of Cultural and Critical Studies at Bowling Green State University. For more on the Haymarket riot, you can check out his book, The Trial of the Haymarket Anarchists, Terrorism and Justice in the Gilded Age, or just read the Wikipedia entry. Since Wikipedia is overseen by a diverse and self-reflective community, the professor's experience prompted some soul-searching. Phoebe Ayers serves on the board of the trustees of the Wikimedia Foundation and is herself an active Wikipedia editor. Phoebe, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
So from a Wikipedian's perspective, what went wrong here?
Well, he should have met a friendlier reception. But one thing about Wikipedia is, of course, it doesn't try to replace the scholarly peer review process. It can't replace that process. And so since its early days, there's been this large-scale discussion among the contributors about how to deal with sources and what makes for a good source and what makes for a notable topic. And that debate has resulted over the years in this huge body of policies and practice. And so when a new contributor like Professor Messer-Cruz comes to the site, he's sort of unwittingly walking into that landscape of extensive discussions and extensive policy.
Wikipedia disallows original research. So even though he could offer accessible transcripts from the Library of Congress, because those were primary source documents, the policy calls for those to be regarded with less weight than historians commenting in a published book on primary documents. And that strikes me as a little half-baked.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with citing the primary sources, but there is something wrong with Wikipedians deciding on the site what historical theories are valid.
He wasn't allowed to have his position represented on the site at all.
Well, but it is now. That's the thing about Wikipedia, right? It's a work in progress, and it's never finished. And so while I think that Professor Messer-Cruz, of course, could have had a better experience, I'm not sure that's a fundamental failing of Wikipedia to move with caution.
isn't he on the site because he aired his frustrating experience in the Chronicle of Higher Education?
Well, certainly that's part of it. But he's also on the site because he's published these valid views.
One last question. He said that he was told later that if he had argued his case more aggressively in the discussion pages, he might have had a better chance at changing the article. But he walked away because that's what you do in academia. He says that there is a fundamental clash of cultures between academic publishing and getting published on Wikipedia.
It is true that it's a very different culture because it's a collaborative community, because it's international, and because the things that we're trying to do are very different from academic publishing. Discussion pages exist attached to all articles, and their point is that you can go there and discuss the content of the article and say, look, I think this thing needs to be changed, and here's why I think that. And that's how the process works. And so he would have likely had more luck engaging in that process of discussion and getting his changes to stick in the first place.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Phoebe Ayers is on the Wikimedia Foundation board. She is also a librarian at the University of California, Davis.
Imagine you're watching a viral video on YouTube, maybe something like a kid hilariously hopped up on drugs after a dental procedure. Wanting to see more kids hopped up on drugs videos, you look to the right of the screen at the list of related videos suggested by YouTube. One of them stands out, though, because not only is it apparently related, it features some serious cleavage. So you click on it, and you get something like this.
The monkey video? Yeah, the monkeys. They're going crazy.
So hi, guys. I just saw this video. And it's of this epic handshake, like the title said. The guys go around dancing and stuff.
Actually, I was looking at this trailer for it, and I thought it was awesome.
You've just encountered what is known as a reply girl. Women who have gamed the Google algorithm with a combination of clever tagging and the ultimate click candy, breasts. And they've made serious money doing it, to the chagrin and sometimes outrage of other YouTubers.
Dear Reply Girls, I am fed up of going to watch the latest Yogscast adventure only to be shocked by a massive pair of boobs along the side of the screen.
Whoever the is making these videos, I'm sorry. When I click on a video and I want to see maybe, you know, some related videos and all I see is your is so annoying.
YouTube aficionados ordinarily use reply videos to communicate with each other on the video sharing site, either to respond to or parody or critique an original video. That is, says Daily Dot writer Frugina Erdig, until reply girls crowded out the legitimate replies.
They reply to every popular video in a low-cut top, and they make sure that their breasts are in focus. And this means that the top of their heads are cut off. And they figured out that if they copy the tags on the video, that their video will appear on the right side of the screen at the very top, and people will click on them because they're showing their cleavage. Because they're making so many videos a day, sometimes they don't really have time to watch the video or to think too much about what they're saying. So they will just talk for about a minute. Sometimes they won't even say anything. And they even begin to make robots, like an animated woman with text-to-voice speech.
My Xbox got the death rings yesterday and now I'm watching this? Video F my life.
A lot of times when videos get viewed a lot, they get approached by YouTube to join the YouTube Partner Program. And this means that they get a cut of ad revenue. So it's all about getting views. That's why they don't spend too much effort on the actual content of the video. Just they want to make sure they get the initial click. And, you know, people don't even watch the whole video. They only watch like the first 10 seconds before they realize what it is.
But people do click on these things. Is it just the cleavage? Is that it?
It is. And that's one reason why the whole YouTube community has gotten very upset over this. They've been called whores and sluts, as well as idiots. You know, a stupid person wouldn't have been able to manipulate the algorithm the way that these women had. They have to be somewhat savvy, and they have to be watching YouTube on a regular basis in order to figure out what video is going to go viral.
I want to drill a little deeper into this notion of the monetization of boobage. A lot of third parties have used cleavage as click candy through the whole history of the internet, including the Huffington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer. It is a surefire way of getting people to click through. Is putting yourself up directly really any different than being a model hired by a third party to put it up on his site to generate clicks?
No, I don't think there is a difference. But you have to realize that the YouTube community isn't getting mad just because of the boobage. You know, they're also getting mad because of lost revenue, because people are manipulating this algorithm, because they're not actually contributing anything to the conversation. So they've sort of bastardized what the reply function should be. The video game commentating team, the Yogscast, would film a story arc. There would be chapters, and the other chapters would be in the related videos bar, but they ended up losing money with the reply girls because people weren't checking out the rest of the chapters, they weren't viewing the rest of their videos because they were covered in boobs.
Now, some people have complained in replies to the reply girls that they don't want to click, they really don't want to, but they just have to.
Yeah, one of the very first males that made a big ruckus on YouTube said that boobs are like Venus flytraps, you know, we can't resist. At one point in the video, he also said, you know something is wrong if I have to complain about breasts. I was just watching one the other day of an 11-year-old boy who was going off about the reply girls.
So these new boob girl videos that make replies absolutely annoy me. It's like YouTube prostitution, and it's really disappointing to see that. And it makes women seem a lot more dumb and incapable, that's just how they're going to make money, showing their boobs. It's absolutely wrong. All these men can't help it clicking on the video. I fell for it.
Google is very attentive to the various ways to game its algorithm and for people to corrupt the system at large. Have they made any attempts to shut down the reply girls?
Yes, they actually are currently in the process of rewriting their algorithm. And they are treating the reply girls as spam. And besides Google, a lot of the girls themselves are actually giving up the reply girl business.
The emotional toll being more than it's worth for the money that they're getting?
Yes. A lot of them have been bullied. They've received threatening messages. People are harassing them on all of their online spaces, as well as posting their public information on various forums. They just don't want to deal with it anymore. But Alejandra Gayton, she was the first woman to make a channel just dedicated to this sort of video. And she said that she's not going to stop making these videos because she likes doing them and she's tired of living below the poverty line.
If you had to fill out their 1040s, what would you call them? Occupation?
Maybe social media expert, I guess. But also there's the whole softcore porn element, so maybe softcore porn social media expert.
Softcore search engine optimization.
Yes.
Frugina, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed myself as well.
Frugina Erdig is a writer for DailyDot.com.
I will not stop even if the algorithm changes. Even if I'm the only one left doing reviews, I'll keep on going no matter what.
I like the way the reply girls reply to videos. They're so smart.
Ooh.
Smart. Smart.
Yeah.
Whoa, whoa. Especially with those thumbnails, yeah. Whatever they say, we don't care. Everyone just stops and stares. The reply girl, whoa, 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 yeah.
That's it for this week's show. On Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary. with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.